This morning, I'm going to read from Hebrews 10, 26 through 39. If we deliberately keep on sinning after we have received the knowledge of the truth, no sacrifice for sins is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. Anyone who rejects the law of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much more severely do you think a man deserves to be punished who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, who has treated as an unholy thing the blood of the covenant that sanctified him, and who has insulted the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, "It is mine to avenge, I will repay." And again, "The Lord will judge his people." It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Remember those earlier days after you had received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering? Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved.
Thank you, Miss Bonnie. And Miss Raylene. Well, many of you will recognize the name C.S. Lewis, no doubt. He was the author of the famous series, The Chronicles of Narnia. Wrote another very famous book called Mere Christianity, The Four Loves, The Great Divorce, on and on, Screwtape Letters. He's wrote a slew of books. Maybe you're familiar with many of them. Well, he wrote another book that's maybe not as famous, though it had its own kind of impact. And at the time when he wrote it, it wasn't intended to be a book. I think that came about a little later. But it's a little book called A Grief Observed. It was a book that Lewis wrote in his own words to survive the mad midnight moments after the death of his wife. He married late in life at 59, a woman whom he knew to be sick at the time. I believe she had cancer. His wife, Joy Davidman, had an unexpected remission not long after they were married and lived, I think, 3-4 years after that, a relatively quality life, and they enjoyed one another. But then she died just a short 4.5 years after they were married, after they were united. Well, Madeline Langle, she was an American writer who's best known for her book titled A Wrinkle in Time. Maybe you're familiar with this book. She wrote a foreword to a 1996 edition of Lewis's book, A Grief Observed. And in that, she says these words. He, that is C.S. Lewis, had been invited to the great feast of marriage, and then the banquet was rudely snatched away from him before he had done more than sample the hors d'oeuvres. If you can get a copy of this book, I'd really encourage you to do so. It's a real short little read, but it's raw and it's real about people, you know, him exposing the struggles and the doubts and the things he was dealing with in his suffering. I recommend it to you, if nothing else, to see this example of a man wrestling with God in his suffering. I don't agree with all the conclusions that he comes to necessarily, but it's raw and it's real. And I think after the fact, Lewis, looking back, probably wouldn't have agreed with a lot of the things that even he concluded in the book. But one of the things he said was this in the book. "Don't talk to me about the consolations of religion, or I shall suspect that you do not understand." In the midst of his suffering, I guess folks would come to him trying to console him and help him, and they would speak of their religion or their faith or whatever. And Lewis was saying, "I don't think you understand where I'm at." Langle writes in response to this comment of Lewis's in this foreword, "For the true consolations of religion are not rosy and cozy, but comforting in the true meaning of that word, comfort. strength to go on living, and to trust that whatever joy was Lewis's wife needs, or anyone we love who has died needs, is being taken care of by that love, capital L, which began it all. Suffering is a very real part of life, and it's unavoidable. It's cooked in to the very fabric of the world we live in, to our bodies, to all around us. Suffering is cooked into it, and there's no way to avoid it. Again, in Lewis's words from this very profound book, it doesn't really matter whether you grip the arms of the dentist's chair or let your hands lie in your lap. The drill drills on. Right? That's life for many of us. But looking back, maybe Lewis would have saw that there's actually a third option. This is what I want to speak to a little bit this morning. Maybe there's one more way to sit or to lie in that dentist's chair as the drill of life does its work on us. And that could be to have our hands in someone else's hands. That someone could be there with us as the drill drills on. To a point, Lewis is right, is he not? That the drill is going to drill, and how you live and what you do are irrelevant when it comes to avoiding suffering to a degree. We all must suffer one way or another, one degree or another. However, we don't have to go it alone. Our bodies hurt, our friends and our families will die. Depression or its shadow seems to be lurking everywhere around every corner. Our cars break down, our money runs out. We solve one problem just to have three more arise. Evil and injustice rob our peace and our security. And love seems to be distant sometimes, does it not? Real love. In the words of Bebo Norman in a song I was listening to very recently, he says this, "I know that love goes around the world that we know, but you never see it coming back. You never see it coming back." For many of us, that's our experience, is it not? All of these problems, and even love itself, seems to elude us sometimes. But one of the remarkably beautiful things, and I hope we'll see from our passage today and what the Lord wants to encourage us with this morning, one of the remarkably beautiful things about walking with Jesus is that you do not have to go it alone. You have a solid and loving, obviously, God, first and foremost, who is with us in the valley of the shadow of death, but also a community of fellow believers who are with you, or should be with you, in your suffering. Oftentimes, wrongly, I think, we believe that Christians are exempt from suffering. Right? You may flick on the television and you may watch very popular pastors who have congregations in the tens of thousands, these meet in stadiums and whatnot, and they will tell you things that seem to suggest that the main thing that God wants to do for you and to give you is success or prosperity or health or whatever it might be. Or that if you live your life the right way, that suffering won't come your way, that you can avoid it. But nothing could be further from the truth. Hear me this morning. I know this is your experience anyway, so I'm preaching at the choir here, really. I think most of us would amen all of that, right? That it's going to come, no matter what you do. But maybe the best example is that the Son of God was not exempt from suffering. Mark 10:45 says this, "Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve." And to what? Give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus came with no false expectations about having people serve him and bless him and move out of their way for him. No, he did it for them, and he suffered. When the hour arrived for Jesus to be betrayed, taken away into custody, questioned, beaten, and eventually killed, what did he say? He said, "Now my heart is troubled." He said this out loud in front of a bunch of people. He said, "Now my heart is troubled. And what shall I say, Father? Deliver me from this hour?" He says, "No. For this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name," he said in John 12. "I came to suffer," Jesus said. That was a part of it. The main thing, in fact. So before maybe we think or attempted to think, or before we listen to folks that we might see on television, to think that we're exempt from suffering or to suppose that maybe things will be different for us because we're Christians. We should hear Jesus' words again that we just read in John 12. But to the man in Luke chapter 9, there was a man who came to Jesus and he said this. Where Jesus was walking along the road, a man said to him, "I'll follow you wherever you go, Lord." And Jesus replied to him, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." The Lord whom we follow at times had no home, no food. He was rejected and poor, considered to be a heretic and a lunatic by many. Following him may bring us the same. So Christians are definitely not exempt, right? And neither are Christians exempt from sin. So the first thing I've kind of talked about, right, is troubles that come our way. There's a, you know, I was sitting at a traffic light some 3 years ago, well, probably 4 years ago now, and I'm sitting there, and it's a rainstorm, and a teenage girl comes flying through the red light, and she hydroplanes, it's in a rainstorm again, she hits an 18-wheeler, and that pushes her into oncoming traffic where I was, and she spins out of control and slams into me and totals the van. I'm just sitting there. That's one kind of suffering, right, that comes your way. We all know what that's like to have a problem, something like that. You have nothing to do with, just there. But there's other troubles, right, that we play more of an active role in, our own sins and problems and struggles. We're not exempt as Christians from making mistakes, right? Sometimes we make the mistake of conveying to people that we're somehow better than they are, or that we know better, or that we're right, and they're, you know, whatever, and that we got it all together. But we all struggle, do we not? Maybe us more than others in many regards. We are filled with our own imperfections and are flawed. And inevitably, we're going to make decisions that result in negative consequences for ourselves or those around us, right? We've all done this in one way or another. We're not just victims, that's the point. We're our own worst enemies. But the question of our text in Hebrews 10 today that it's going to address, I think, is the question of perseverance, right? So we've got the suffering that comes our way that we have nothing to do with. We've got our own sufferings and trials and tribulations that we cause. But the question is, how do we persevere? How do we get through it? Given that life is full of suffering, given that life is oftentimes unbearable, like it was for C.S. Lewis in this trial that he went through with his wife. I mean, there were moments where he said he was just going crazy, didn't know what to do with himself. Given that life is shot through with frustration and injustice, how do we get through? How do we persevere to the end? This is the big question, right? How do we not allow the suffering brought on by our own sins to destroy us? How do we not allow the suffering brought on by the world, the things around us, to destroy us? Well, the answer, I think, as I see this passage in context, the answer to these perseverance questions here, according to our passage today, is to be a part of a faith-filled, eternity-focused Christian community. First and foremost, of course, to be connected to the Lord Jesus Himself. That's a given, I think, here in the passage. But to be part of a faith-filled community. We talked about community last week some, so just a real quick review, how critical it was to meet regularly with Christ's body, to be a part of a local church, giving and receiving. We mentioned some of the ways in which our meetings here at Red Door should and do resemble birthday gatherings. Remember, I used that as a picture of maybe what it would look like for us to gather on Sunday mornings, because I think so many of us understand a birthday party. We've all had family birthday parties, and that makes sense to us. But I think maybe Sunday mornings is a little bit more hard to grasp. What's that supposed to look like? What are we supposed to do on a Sunday morning? I mean, we all kind of maybe have a rough sketch, but a birthday is something that makes a lot of sense. So I use that as a picture for us. Some of the things we talked about was being a part of a family, right? Doesn't matter what happens at the birthday party. And I gave some crude examples, probably. No matter what happens at the birthday party, we're still part of the family, right? And we go, and we're committed. We talked about being part of a spiritual family, using our gifts and being filled up as we pour ourselves out. We're filled up by God and worshiping Christ all the while. We talked about those things. Well, today's passage, right on the heels of that previous passage, shows us the importance of our faith community in the fight to persevere. in the fight to endure suffering, which will come your way. And no doubt many of you are in the thick of it right now. Verses 26 through 31, if you glance at them in your passage, constitute the strongest warning in all of Hebrews up to this point. I think he's had three or four kind of warning passages where clearly he's saying, hey, heads up here, something very serious is going to happen. This is the third or fourth one now. These verses reiterate the point that was made that we've heard already back in Hebrews 3. Verses 12 and 13 say this real quick. See to it, brothers. This is from Hebrews 3. See to it, brothers and sisters, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. But encourage one another daily, as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness. Do you hear the role that the Christian community is to play to keep us from being deceived by sin, to be hardened by sin? This community thing somehow works out, helps us to avoid sin and falling in and being hardened and falling into unbelief. Well, our church, our faith community, plays a non-negotiable role in helping us to persevere in the fight against sin. Our own sins and our own struggles. That's why I think this strongest warning in all of Hebrews is right on the heels of verse 25 in Hebrews 10. Let's go back and read verse 25, okay? Not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Why is this warning right on the heels of that, about meeting together? Well, maybe some of y'all are already kind of going there in your minds, but it's because clearly this meeting together is a part of the prevention of falling into whatever the warning is suggesting. Right? So this plays a role somehow in avoiding the verses 26 through 31, which are horrific to think about. This judgment thing. There is a day, which verse 25 refers to, the day, capital D, the day, that's coming. And it's a judgment day. And how do we know it's speaking of judgment? Well, if you look at verses 26 through 31, that's what it's talking about, right? It's judgment. He doesn't use the phrase judgment day in verse 25. But what comes right after that, it's judgment, right? It says, look at verses 30 and 31 especially. The Lord will judge His people. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. There's the word judge there, right? So judgment is clearly in view with this day. The capital D is judgment day. And we'll all stand before God. Now the beauty of the Christian message, right, is that you and I, as believers in Jesus Christ, will stand and be judged not based on our own merits, but upon the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ. Right? The one who fulfilled the law of God perfectly for us, bore the wrath of God and all that. So we'll stand righteous because of what Jesus did. So for us, there shouldn't be a fear there in the way maybe that there should be for the world. But nonetheless, we'll all stand there. So the question is this morning, are you in Jesus? That's the real deeper question maybe for you all. But if we're not careful, even if we are in Jesus, seems to be the point of this passage, which is kind of scary here, that if you're not diligent and you're lackadaisical, there seems to be peril. You know, the passage is saying, if you don't persevere and you're diligent, you might end up like Israel, which what happened to them in the promised land? They didn't get in, right? So that's why this warning is here. But I'm not going to dwell on that. We've already looked at all of that in the previous weeks. Okay, somehow being part of a faith community, though, not forsaking meeting together, even if we don't like each other sometimes, is a part of how we persevere. That's a part of it. Okay, well, do you remember the story of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10? Maybe y'all remember the story of this Samaritan who came along and helped the gentleman who had been beaten and robbed and left for dead. Y'all remember that story? Okay, I'm seeing some heads nod. Well, most of us kind of ignore, right? We focus on the Good Samaritan. We ignore the fact that the priest or the Levite just passed right on by, right? They saw this guy there and they're like, psh, that's a little inconvenient. It might take a little bit too much time. I don't have money, whatever. I'm not going to help the guy out. We see this poor person suffering as an inconvenience to ourselves or as being awkward or whatever, and so we look the other way, right? We see something maybe we don't understand fully, the Samaritan, or excuse me, the Jew, if you are the Samaritan, we say, no, I'm not going to step into that situation. But Jesus told this story. Why? Why did Jesus tell this story? He was showing people what it meant to be a neighbor, right? That everybody's your neighbor, and you should treat every person as this Samaritan did. Truly, he was the one who acted as the other should have. Well, of all people, you and I as Christians should be good Samaritans, right? Now, where am I going with this? Well, Jesus said that there was one thing that would separate Christians from everyone else. Do you remember what that thing was? By this, the world will know you are my disciples. What was that? Love, right? And clearly, this Samaritan exercised love towards the gentleman on the road. John 13:35. By this, the world will know you are my disciples. But love, where is love most powerfully demonstrated? Well, first of all, in community. It's got to have, you've got to be loving someone, right? So community is a given, but where? It's in suffering, right? It's when the guy's beaten up on the side of the road. And even though it's an inconvenience to you, and you'd have to make a sacrifice to love him, that's where it's most clearly displayed. Love is most obvious when great suffering is involved. And let me demonstrate really quick. You're going to see where I'm going with all this. Talking about the importance of community and being together. There's another book that's by a gentleman named Chuck Colson. Maybe you are familiar with Chuck Colson. Founder of big prison ministry, whatever. Just a remarkable individual. I believe he passed not too long ago. Maybe it's about a year ago now that he passed on. But he wrote a book. Actually, Miss Bonnie donated a copy or two to our church library called The Faith. And in the prologue of that book, it's some really, really powerful stories about Christian examples of sacrificial love. And I want to read one of those to you really, really quick. So let me do that. It's a rather lengthy quote, but the story is remarkable, and it's going to help, I think, outline what I'm trying to say to us this morning. Okay. Christians practiced the same inexplicable sacrifice and love in Roman times. He spoke of another story about an Amish person or an Amish group of people showing forgiveness and love to someone who had brutally murdered some of their group. And he's saying that these Christians practiced the same kind of love as they did in Roman times. Catastrophic events were far more common in the ancient world than in our own. The ancient city of Antioch, for example, suffered 41 natural and social catastrophes during Roman rule, an average of one every 15 years. Riots, floods, earthquakes, fires, military sieges, plagues, and so on constantly threatened the centers of Roman civilization to wipe the centers of Roman civilization off of the map. In size, most Roman cities were little more than urban postage stamps. Most people lived in multi-story tenements divided like rabbit warrens into one-room apartments. Every household had an open fire for cooking, and whole city blocks often went up in flames like so much kindling, which happened here, in the late 1800s, right? This whole block went down in flames. So maybe the people here can relate to that. The filth of chamber pots often rained down on public thoroughfares, as the records of public citation attest. So we have records that show all these catastrophes and how common these sorts of things were. With sewage in the streets, air smoke-filled, and the incredible crowding at a time when soap was not yet used, the cities of ancient Rome were perfect cultures for communicable diseases. Plagues in Roman times sealed the fates, listen to this, of 30 to 40% of a city's inhabitants. Can you imagine? Half our town almost being wiped out by some sickness or illness. And the onset of a plague, at the onset of a plague, what do you think the wealthy did in Roman times? They left. They went into their estate homes out in the country and they avoided it. Right? Paganism didn't teach them that human life was sacred, right? Worshipping the pagan idol worship of that time didn't teach any of these principles that we now kind of take for granted, that you would help the weak and the poor and those who are suffering. The growing number of people who called themselves Christian, however, believed that each human being was made in the image of a loving God. The Christian's God expected that his followers would acknowledge his love by sacrificing themselves for others. They were to extend God's love not merely to their families and friends, but even to their enemies. Love one another became their standard. So let's see. He presents a situation. between a man named Fortunus and another one named Crispus here. And he's going to tell a little story of what it might look like during that time. Imagine a young Christian, we'll call him Fortunus, living in one of Rome's death trap cities in AD 166, at the time of the first great plague, which was probably smallpox. In the street, Fortunus meets a fellow believer, Crispus, and together they pull a hand-drawn cart toward the fountain at the city's center. The place is usually alive at this early hour, neighbors calling out to one another from tenement windows, shops opening up, and the streets rumbling with heavy carts bearing wares. But now, it remains quiet, except for Fortunus's own cart's creak and the clatter of the intermittent wails of plague victims in the apartments overhead, which make the chill of the morning that much colder and each step even harder. The fountain is the last place the diseased and dying can go for water once their neighbors and families notice their illness and abandon them, as was the common practice of the day. There, Fortunus and Crispus find another 20 plague victims, many lying on the ground, their clothes bloodied by the hemorrhaging pustules brought on by the disease's first phase. Others are already dead. The two Christians load those who cannot walk onto their cart and encourage those who can come along to come along. Later that morning, Fortunus and Crispus will come back for those who have already died and see that they are properly buried. Their city's Roman garrison probably had a hospital complete with an isolation ward for cases of communicable diseases like smallpox, but this was only for Roman soldiers and would have been unavailable to Christians. Fortunus and Crispus take the plague victims to the house of a wealthier member of their community. Smallpox causes fever, headache, back, stomach pain, along with vomiting. After these flu-like symptoms come the pox, white, jellied, running sores that spread in a polka dot pattern over the face, down the throat, into the eyes, and over the hands and feet. There would have been little for the ancient Christians to do but to give the victims water, keep them as clean as possible, and encourage them with kindness and prayer. Fortunus, who had left his wife and children at home that morning so that he could spend the day carting victims to makeshift hospitals and trying to ease their pain, knew that his care for the ill would probably end his own life. Every time he looked into the pocked face of a victim, he was looking into the face of death. But the care that Christians showed often did result in their succumbing to the plague themselves. But paradoxically, their compassion did not deplete their Christian ranks in the long term. Quite the reverse. Tending to the sick increased the disease's survival rate by as much as 2/3, and this witness attracted many new converts. By acting on the teachings of Christ without regard to their own welfare, these Christians, against all expectations, progressed from being a small sect to the dominant cultural group. The unprecedented teachings of Christianity gave people a reason to care for the sick and the destitute. Only Jesus taught that his followers could find him in their neighbor. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. People who saw Christians behave this way were amazed. But where do you think modern hospitals come from? Where do you think our cultural values here in America of advocacy for the weak, for the voiceless, support groups, caring for the poor and needy, and so on, all of these values were not present in Roman culture and aren't necessarily present in many of the cultures across the world even today. They came from the teachings and the example of Jesus Christ in the early Christian community. Rome did not make these assumptions. Rome was changed by the power of this loving example. Hey, what's your point, Pastor? Why are you going into all this? The point is that love does not happen in a vacuum. That love was forged in the fire of Christian community, in the context of loving Christian community. It was born out of an experience of love that people had with Jesus, with his disciples, and the disciples took that to others. Those disciples took that to others. But it was built out of love. That's my story. I shared a little bit about my testimony a couple of weeks ago. Maybe y'all remember that. I didn't share the beginning of it. I won't go all into it now. But that's what ultimately, for me, won me over. Yeah, there was all the arguments about science and those sorts of stumbling blocks that I had. But ultimately, it was the testimony and the power of the love that I saw in this Christian community. I'd never known it anywhere else. They loved each other in a powerful way, and they loved me. Responding to suffering, persevering through suffering and trials, whether they're our own, somebody else's, whether we're guilty of bringing them on ourselves, or somebody else brought them to us, persevering through suffering is a byproduct of being connected to loving Christian community. Faith-filled, eternity-focused, Christ-centered community. So the last half of our passage today, verses 32 through 39, is talking about persevering through suffering that comes our way that we had nothing to do with. That first chunk, right, was about judgment and avoiding judgment day, which would be because of our own errors and our own sins, right? Our active role in suffering. Now the second half is suffering that comes our way. You're thrown in jail, right? You've got a friend in jail. Car wrecks, whatever. Someone robs your stuff, right? It says they've had their goods plundered. Look at verses 32 to 34 really quick with me. Remember those earlier days after you had received the light when you endured in a great conflict full of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. Other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You suffered along with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. These Christians, the writer is speaking of here in Hebrews, started out this way and began to wander away from it. They started out loving one another sacrificially. They went to prison together, right? Or my boy was whatever, my buddy over here, my mate as they call him in some parts of the world, was thrown into jail and I went to visit with him, right? I went to be with him and to suffer with him. You know, I got robbed or insulted publicly and I stood with those who were suffering. They were doing this and they had wandered away. But how did they respond when they were doing what they were supposed to do? This is what's amazing to me. Do you see it in the passage there? Joyfully. Is that not amazing? Do you not see that word there? That adjective? They responded with joy. They joyfully accepted the confiscation of their property. Why? How could they do that? Because they knew they had something greater waiting for them, right? Something greater. They were a part of a community that was reminding them that this is not about this. There's something else coming. Your body's failing. Your life's falling apart. It's hang on. It's all right. There's something greater coming. They were a part of people who were reminding them about these things. They knew something greater was coming. Their treasures were in heaven, not on earth. We're approaching Reformation Day, so it's appropriate to quote the reformer Martin Luther who said, "Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever." This kingdom will not last and it will be gone. It's all going to burn one day. That's the truth. It's all going to burn. There's another kingdom that's coming. The Jerusalem that's coming down out of heaven that will last forever. We can lose our things in this life, our health, whatever it might be. Though it's hard, and no doubt, I'm not making light of suffering. But the reality is, it's a shadow. Something greater is coming. So how are we able to persevere? How were they able? How was Luther able in his time? He was pursued constantly in his day, yet he wrote these words, "Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also." How was he able to persevere? These people in the book of Hebrews, well, they were meaningfully connected into a faith-filled, eternity-focused, Christ-centered community. All the suffering that they faced that is mentioned here is not done in isolation. Do you see that in the passage? Right? They went to prison together. They were insulted together. They lost their goods together. Right? There was a togetherness. Like those from that Toy Story 3 incinerator clip. Right? There weren't all these words, maybe. Maybe in their gatherings they were encouraging each other with words. But in the moment of trial, they were together. So the bottom line here is this. This is the big point I'm driving home today. We need our faith community more than we can imagine. Press into your community. Be with one another. Not just on Sunday, especially on Sunday, be together. But not just on Sunday. I wanted to mention to you three ways to be connected, okay? Sunday morning, all right? Get here when you can. I know there's conflicts of schedule and all that. I understand that. People got to travel. People got work. People got issues. I understand. Be here when you can. Get meaningfully connected on Sunday morning. Another one is our small group ministry, right? If you're not in a small group, please get in a small group if you're able. I know, again, it's challenges. I get that there's fights and schedule stuff. I get it. But get connected to a small group. We've got a few. I was trying to do a printout to give you a list of all the small groups we've got going on. We've got five or six different groups right now, from youth night to men's group to there's a ladies group that just got kicked up. There's a couple other groups that are starting, thinking about getting together. There's a Monday night group, a Thursday night group. There's plenty of places for you to plug into a small group at all different times throughout the week, morning, night, evening, all over the place. So we should be able to make that happen. But small groups, I'll print it off next week because our printer messed up this morning and whatever. The other one is this. So Sunday morning, small groups, and then our ministry teams. Okay? You do have a list of those in your insert there. Okay? You can be the person receiving the cart when you're suffering, right? You can have Fortunus and Crispus come to you when you're sick and you're suffering, and that's great. We all need that. But you can also be the person to take the cart, right? You can be the carter or the carted, I guess. Right? Both are a blessing, and we need both. So get on a ministry team if you're not on one. You see the options there. I know it doesn't sound exciting to serve on a committee or whatever, but we need people to do what we do here at Red Door Church. Okay, let me close with the parable of the lost sheep here, okay? Y'all remember the story of the lost sheep, right? Let me just read it really quick. It sounds so much better coming off the lips of Jesus than it does mine. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law murmured, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." You know, they're judging Jesus and saying, "Who is this guy? Who does he think he is? He thinks he's some prophet and he's meeting with these messed up people." And then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home and calls his friends, probably not on the phone at that point, but he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." Right? It's a powerful story. But one of the subtle teachings that maybe we miss sometimes in this parable is that no sheep ought to be alone. Do you see that? The assumption is that it's good to be with the group. No sheep should be out in open field in danger by itself, but all should be part of a larger faith community, a community that protects it, nurtures it, and encourages it to persevere in faith. Suffering will come, and many of us are in the midst of it right now. But I agree with Madeline L'Engle. I want to quote that quote at the beginning, from the beginning again for you. I agree with her words when she says, "For the true consolations of religion are not rosy and cozy, but comforting in the true meaning of that word," right? Platitudes don't help people who are suffering, right? But what does? Come forth with strength. Sit with them. Be with them. Be present with people when they are suffering. Be a part. Bring them into community if they're not in community. That strength is first found abiding in Jesus and abiding in community. It's there that God comes with His strength to heal our diseases, to bind up our wounds, to teach us how to live, encourage us when we need it. It's there that we find people ready to visit us when we're in prison, to give us water when we're thirsty, to visit us when we're lonely, to pray for us when we're weak, to pray for us when we're weak, to help us to be joy-filled when injustice and evil come knocking at our door. To help us to remember what? That a greater day is coming. Capital D, day, is coming. When our true treasures and our true happiness will be revealed. In just a little while, He who is coming will come and will not delay. And my righteous one will live by faith. By being connected to faith-filled community. Are you ready? Let's pray together.